was that?
I don't know.
Yeah, we're rolling. You're trying to make friends with a microphone here. I don't know why.
It's called eating the mic in the business, Kevin.
Is that what that's called?
I believe it is.
Eating the mic?
You have to get right up to it like this. Now I'm.
Who says that? Now I got to throw away that windscreen. Now I really have to throw away that. Now I have to take that windscreen to the police, and they're going to have to file a report.
Disinfect it. File a report from.
Yeah.
I think we need a theme song.
We have a theme song.
We do?
It's the
Nah, we need lyrics.
Okay, you get right on that. Go ahead.
Marathon chat, marathon chat.
Get William Shatner to sing it.
Kevin and Joe. Oh, Kevin. Here we go. It's marathon chat. Thank you. You like that?
Or was that Tony Bennett? Who was that?
That was a little I Gotta Be Me channeled into, which I like to think is our theme song, too.
That would be an odd theme song, because which one of us is me?
I. The collective I. We are.
Now you're making no sense.
We're both like parts of the same brain.
Mr. English teacher.
Not anymore. I have retired from that career, my friend. We should just get to the main event. Because
yes,
we're wasting
there.
Time.
I'm letting you take precious marathon time. I've got soup.
Vamping.
I got soup on the stove.
He's got soup on the stove, and that's a euphemism for...
Nothing. I have soup on the stove.
He's pregnant.
I'm not pregnant.
Okay, so let's see. For those of you who
there we go. Suddenly we're in Howard Stern territory. Thank you, Joan F.
For those of you who've never listened to this before, this is the continuing oral history of the Columbus Marathons.
I wish I could have captured the look on your face. You're doing the face, the Picard face palm.
I am. I'm the worst at that.
Jesus, why am I doing this?
Most people probably think I'm lying all the time because I have the worst tells. Like, I have the Andy tell. If I'm feeling happy sometimes, I'll look pained. I don't know why. Cover all the bases. Anyway.
You like Brick from The Middle. I'm lying.
Okay, so as with the other two, we have not done a lot of prep for this.
No.
We figured out vaguely. This is just not good today.
I'm just letting you go.
This is like the drunk podcast today. We've planned out a rough timeline of what we want to talk about today, but we haven't really gone back and pulled out memories for this.
I just pulled up Dave Zucchini's page. Hall of Marathonia.
It's Zucchini, not Zoo.
I say Zucchini?
Yeah, get pissed. Well, and he's an angry bearded man.
Well, I'm an angry bearded man.
Well,
bring it on!
The irresistible force and the immovable object.
Bring it on, next sucker.
Coming to shock around the clock. It's October 17th
I'm
and 18th.
Fat guys at the movies.
Yeah,
I am impervious to insult.
Boy, he's gonna know you're calling him out now. Just wait. Okay, so anyway, we don't have like a list of stories planned out.
No.
This is kind of freestyling about our memories of these things. So last time we left off with the final Drexel North Marathon.
The demise of the Drexel North.
The 1995 sci-fi marathon and the promise that maybe, just maybe, the marathons would continue. And if you listen to the last podcast, the mammoth 2 hour and 15 minute megathon of fun, you know that we kind of teased that saying, but that would not be all that you'd see for the marathons.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. However, it was touch and go there for a while.
Yeah.
So spring 1995, here's a little amusing side anecdote. And this gets into why the remaining podcasts that we do will be different. Because spring 1995, I ran my first video horror marathon. Because at that time, I wasn't sure if the marathons would continue at all.
And as we remember, you were like decked out with homemade t-shirts and... You know, crazy stuff. You were crazy.
Oh yeah. Oh, you mean the schlock around the clock homemade t-shirt I made. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. I was so in the bag for the marathon at that point. It was like this deep obsessive love affair. So right at the end of my senior year of high school, end of May 1995, I held in my sister's basement a approximately 30-hour maybe. 27-hour horror marathon.
It says here from 12 noon until, I would imagine, Texas Chainsaw played the last one, so it would probably be until about 6 or so.
Sounds about right, yeah.
The next day. So about, yeah.
And it was really
30, a metric day.
About, yeah.
30 hours.
I like that. We should have called it that. We would have had more.
That's not my own. I have to give that props to the Mystery Science Theater people.
That's okay. Steal if you wish. I won't judge. I like thieves.
No, good for you.
And I like Thief. James Caan's great. Yeah, that completely, yeah.
Okay, I got it.
Anyway, hey, all you people out there in podcast land.
Yes.
So I ran that, and that was, for me at 18 was like awesome to run a video horror marathon and to do that and to show like just a bunch of stuff I wanted to show.
You want, and I'm looking at the lineup here, you can go to the Hall of Marathonia. Did I say that right?
I think it's Marathonia, maybe.
Marathonia, okay. Yeah. Marathonia.
Yeah.
That sounds like some place that like Ator or Redsonia lived. Anyways.
Yeah, because we're not getting too geeky here, are we?
Oh, yeah, nah. Why not? I already threw out an MSD joke. So, but no, it starts off with Night of the Living Dead, then Horror of Dracula. So, I mean, but it has very specific times. 12 p.m., Night of the Living Dead.
Oh,
1:56
yeah.
p.m. Horror of Dracula. I mean, did you put interstitials or did you just do tape with no breaks?
Oh yeah, there were interstitials in there, definitely. I'm not sure looking at this because I have not looked at the program in a while. If I actually put 1:56 or if Dave just kind of put that on. Well, because
Then it goes to 3:18, then 5:74. Then those are normal, and then you get down here 7:04 in the morning.
Yeah.
2:27 in the afternoon.
I don't know. At 18, I might have thought that was like a fun joke.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I just, it was like I had any concept of time at 18.
Okay.
I was so backwards. I didn't know what day was, what night was. I was.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So was your sister cool with this?
Totally.
She was?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She was. She's the one, I think, who offered it to me.
Oh, wow.
If I remember correctly.
How many people showed up?
In total, maybe 10, and I think about 5 stayed almost the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was
like,
cool.
Like to the bitter end?
Yeah. Yeah.
What'd you have for food? Now, this is where I'm curious, because I've done my own little marathons at home.
Well, yours are like the grad version of what I did.
Well, but I also have more technology. Yeah. I mean, you have smart TVs and YouTube and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, back then, you just had tape.
Today, geez, if I wanted to do it today, like, I would do what you do.
Yeah.
And deck everything out and have, yeah, with having the technology that's available, it would be great.
Yeah.
Food, it was bring your own. Made some coffee. I think maybe
we made some coffee over 30 hours.
Yeah,
thinking coffee.
I think we ordered some pizza.
So it's basically a weird church potluck,
kind of
with horror movies.
Yeah,
okay.
I like that.
You have some interesting choices here because you have Dr. Strangelove.
Oh well, that's the thing. That marathon was me at 18 saying, "What do I have on VHS?"
Yeah.
And what are some things I like? And I had just seen Strangelove at the Drexel North not that long ago, so this marathon was kind of like a horror marathon, but it was also a semi-tribute to the Drexel North,
okay.
Which had closed like a week. Oh, no, actually, now I'm remembering this.
Because it was like the last that came from the Drexel North was beginning of May, and this was late.
Literally.
Beginning of April, then this is late May.
The Drexel North closed that week.
Mm-hmm.
That Saturday, before the marathon started,
yeah.
We went to the North, and that's when they had the fire sale, where they sold everything, because we all bought a seat, and I brought the seat, not even mounted, but I brought it down into my sister's basement, which was strange sitting on that, because it's half falling apart the whole time. It was that morning when they had the fire sale. So part of it was us paying tribute to the theater itself. I got a piece of wood from the outside from the wood paneling that I still have today. Trust me. Hey, hello. Right. I put that in front of the TV that we had. Yeah, I was such a hardcore obsessive.
That's crazy, man.
I really was.
I actually ran. I ran a couple of back in the late. This would have been the early 90s. I did my own. It was just for friends of mine, but it wasn't like. But I did that. I had a little. We went in the TV room and we watched a bunch of movies and I programmed it. I did two of them. I did one where I programmed. I don't even know what the program was, but I remember I specifically laid out what I wanted to show. I programmed it.
Mm-hmm.
The second year I did it was like, what did I have on VHS? So you know, like had Batman and stuff like that.
Well, this year was like, you can tell by looking at the list, I had no concept of pacing, timing, any of that stuff. It was just, what's a bunch of stuff I really like?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have this 1-2 punch of Dr. Strangelove, Clockwork Orange. Apparently you did Stanley Kubrick.
I guess, yeah.
Tribute and, right
and,
in the middle
and,
of the
and
day.
The Shining later on, so it was like
that's true.
Tons of Kubrick. Well, that was like the first time I had seen any of those films was around that time in my life.
And Phenomenon was knocked out of the lineup. Was that?
That did not end
print availability?
I don't think I actually got it at that point. Yeah.
Although, I do notice what plays at midnight is American favorite,
Suspiria. In fact, this whole thing is kind of a extended George Romero, Dario Argento, Stanley Kubrick tribute, now that I look at it. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
With a little Sam Raimi tossed in there.
It definitely has a feel of, if, knowing you and your taste, it definitely feels like something you programmed in your youth.
Oh, yeah. And what you have to understand, too, and what some of you out there in podcast land might not even know, is, say, showing Suspiria, Dawn of the Dead. I'm looking at the list right now. And what was supposed to be Phenomena. I always think that, too. Back then, getting those uncut, I had to order away to a company. I remember it was called Midnight Video in Pennsylvania. They might still operate today.
And back then,
if you want to order uncut versions of like Italian films, you have to order away to someone who has bought the exorbitantly priced Japanese uncut Laserdisc and done tape dubs of them.
Wow.
And that's how you get those things. And back then it was great. It was like, oh my God.
Those are rarities.
This is pre-internet ubiquity.
Now you can just find them on YouTube now it's or easy. Some BitTorrent site.
Which is great. Hacks. But back then there was a real mysterious appeal. Like, I wonder what this is going to be. Some of the Argento films, the first time I saw them, they were on Japanese Laserdisc and they had burnt in Japanese subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bizarre watching that, but at the same time, you were seeing this because no one in the States would license this stuff.
I mean, it probably had a real grindhouse feel to it.
It did.
Yeah.
It did. Dawn of the Dead, the version I showed in here, or at this marathon.
Is the unrated version?
Is the extended version, as they call it, the Khan cut, the one that Romero put together for Khan in 1978 with temp tracks.
Who did he put it together for?
Khan, the Khan Film Festival. Oh, boy, they're flying fast and furious today, aren't they?
Yeah,
they
are.
Bad puns. By the way, I don't really know Kevin. I just do this as, you know, a favor to his sons who pity their poor, poor father. When I bought this tape, I was used to seeing the 2-hour version. Hmm. And literally the tape is a dub off of someone renting the 16mm extended cut.
Hmm.
So the quality's not great, but you see a bunch of stuff that you otherwise didn't see.
And the only way to see it. So you're,
at
you
that
know,
point,
quality, we're worrying about quality, isn't it?
Yeah, at that point, the only way to see it. And obviously that changed when Anchor Bay really went whole hog into doing a lot of these. But yeah, I mean, some of the stuff I would play, especially the next year when I did 48 hours, my extended
you're
God.
An idiot. Jesus Christ.
Well, in my youthful stupidity / enthusiasm, I thought, hey, some people complained the year before that they wanted to show up, but they couldn't. So I said, why don't we, instead of doing Saturday into Sunday, why don't we do Friday night into Sunday night?
Oh,
then
Jesus.
Anyone can stop by any time they want to. And me being the complete obsessive freak that I was.
Yeah.
/ R, Joe, hello. That was my conscience talking.
Wow.
Or conscience talking. In 1996, I got a friend of mine to agree to let me use his basement for 48 hours.
Oh, my
8 p.m. Friday to 8 p.m. Sunday. We did not finish the whole 48 hours. We made it to about 45. And it was my extended...
Because you programmed Tenebrae at 2:25
second. Well, I'm going to go whole hog at that point and say it was my extended tribute to David Cronenberg and Dario Argento, two of my faves.
Both well known for high action, intense pacing, wake you up in the middle of the night kind of movies.
This marathon was like me vomiting it out everything that I liked at that point.
It
and
is
saying, hey everybody, come over and like look into my skull for
I've bumped ahead of the next marathon we would talk about, but yeah, I'm now looking at it. Got Dawn of the Dead. Guess what else was on the list?
Suspiria. Hello. I showed Dawn of the Dead all 3 years, by the way.
Yeah. And you got Deep Red. That's nice at 5:30 a.m. on the second day.
Everybody was asleep at that point.
I'm sure they were.
Dead Ringers, I got mad because it was third from last, I think.
And second
to last.
It was the penultimate.
And a few of my friends were making fun of it at that point, and I got really mad. I was thinking, like, you have to take this seriously. What is this? You know, there's a tape that exists somewhere.
Again, like the Joker.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, there was a tape somewhere that exists that someone borrowed and never gave
someone
back to me.
Someone makes fun of Suspiria, you're all okay, but you make fun of Dead Ringers and everyone loses their mind.
This tape at the end of it is me giving my closing statement over a microphone.
Just shaming everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And saying and saying like, well, sometimes you make fun of things you're scared of, and that's why you do it. And it gets don't spend 48 hours with your close friends watching
like
movies. It
Joe
Neff,
the angry young man.
Yeah, I fancied myself quite the purist at that point. So we did that, and then Sanity took back over, and the next year we did an extended drive-in tribute because I was huge into the drive-ins at that point. In fact, I renamed the event Night of the Living Drive-In.
Yeah.
And
did you still do it in a basement, or did you
back
just
to my sister's basement at that point?
Well, yeah. That's not. You should have done it like you should have hung up a screen in your.
I said that we were resurrecting
driveway.
The event as the world's first underground drive-in.
Oh man.
Which doesn't really make a lot of sense, but you know what? Too bad.
Teddy bears make strange bedfellows.
That's a long story. What that was, yeah.
Again, you know, you showed a razor. Did you show a razor head all three times?
No, just twice. The brood I showed again because no one had been awake the year before for it. Mm. Basket case we'd never shown before. Basket case ended up showing later. That schedule is not accurate.
You started it at midnight.
Yeah.
That's another daring move.
I guess so, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to start a 12-hour event at midnight. It's another thing to start... What was this, 86 hours this year? Was that what it is? Four whole days in a basement?
Yeah, something like that. This was the year we had our first real premiere, quote-unquote.
Taxi Driver was in there?
Yeah, well, Taxi Driver I still defend. Clive Barker once said he considered Taxi Driver to be a horror film.
I can give you that.
And I thought it was interesting to show it. This was the year we had our first, quote-unquote, premiere, because I had a bootleg tape of Dario Argento's The Stendhal Syndrome. Which had not played in Columbus, and so in the program I advertised it as the Columbus premiere of the Stendhal Syndrome. Mm. Take that for what you will.
And he got arrested.
Yeah. Several times. So, yeah, that year was kind of fun, but then that led into... I stopped doing those because real life intruded and I started doing real things. But anyway, let's rewind back.
Go back to
1995.
We're leaving the basement right now.
Yeah, okay. There's a very important thing that happens also in 1995, aside from me doing a video horror marathon. And
by the way, just I want to point out, you know, we're veering off the traditional Ohio marathon, the Ohio science fiction horror marathon path. Yeah. The ones that, like, I know there have been a lot of events over the years that have cropped up here and there for 1 or 2 years at a time. If you were not involved in the planning of it, we're really not going to talk about those because then it's just
that's
showed
fine.
Up.
Yeah.
So my apologies to anybody listening if they did one, they're involved in one that existed, and that's not to downplay that, but
no.
It's only kind of one of the inside story.
The reason I mentioned the video marathons is because they were kind of like my training ground for getting involved with the real ones.
Guys, thank your lucky stars that Joe made the mistakes he made then.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And not,
I would never make those mistakes
these
today.
Would not exist.
Never.
If we did a 48-hour marathon with Dario Argento movies in the middle of the night.
What could go wrong? I don't see a problem with that. No.
All right, so let's talk about...
Fall 1995, a big, momentous event happens in my life, and that is I went to work for the Drexel.
Now, what was that again? The Drexel?
The Drexel?
Never heard of it.
No, I haven't either, yeah. I go to work for them. And that was a huge dream of mine because I was a huge, huge, huge fanboy, obviously, as you probably can guess at this point, for the marathons and for the theater.
Did you show up with your own Drexel staff shirt?
No, I didn't. I hadn't gone that far. Thank God. No, fall 1995, I started putting in applications there. And I was that guy. I just kept bugging them and calling and saying, do I get an interview? And like, are you hiring still?
And they're like, we don't have any positions.
Yeah.
Just wait till somebody gets
well, here's an untold story. Mm-hmm. And this is how things might have changed. I applied at the same time to the General Cinema Westland 8, which is
still
longer open.
I was about to say, that was still in existence then?
I got an interview with them. Ooh. And the interview went fairly well. And they asked me, at one point, they said, well, here on your application, you put that you quit your previous job because of unsatisfactory work conditions. And they said, what are those about? And I said, I basically kind of slammed my old boss at my part-time job I'd had the year before.
Where's your part-time job?
Media Play. Yeah.
That den of vipers at Media
three,
Play.
Three quarters of the audience.
Not
goes,
an
What's
incredible
that?
Universe.
Not an incredible universe. So I think that's what made me not get that job. Mm. because of that...
We can't have somebody who's going to slam their old bosses at media play.
No. Because of that, I wasn't working at that theater. The no. Drexel had put a little hiring freeze on because they were switching managers. Mm. But then, because I didn't get that job, a week later, they opened back up applications at the Drexel. I reapplied. And then finally, the night came. I remember this night. Jeff Frank himself called me at home at 10 o'clock at night.
Oh.
And said, hey, we're not hiring right now, but if you want to get your foot in the door, I could always use someone to work for me, passing out flyers like to local businesses for like $5 an hour. You just keep a little time card and I'd pay you for that.
So you'd be basically like those Mexicans that they give strip club things at Vegas.
Kind of.
They shove that in kind your face as you're walking down the street.
Kind of like that. But I went around to local businesses and I'd be like, I'm from the Drexel and I'm dropping off some flyers back when that was like a huge thing that you
flyers
did.
Were a big thing.
Oh,
though.
Yeah, yeah.
You needed flyers. Flyers was your communication.
It was a key part of the Drexel machine back in those days. Yeah. Me, I thought, wow, I can't believe the guy who runs the Drexel's calling me at home. Oh, my God. So I took him up on that offer, and it was kind of cool. And for like
he didn't check your bad-mouthing media play?
Obviously not.
Obviously that didn't happen. You didn't get Yelp reviews.
Well,
back
what happened was I did that for about a month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, mid-November, the new guy who was managing the Drexel, Dwayne Williams. Dwayne is probably not listening today, but Dwayne was like probably the best direct supervisor I ever had in my life, in my work career.
Wow.
He was only like 23 or so. But
way better than media play.
Yeah, just a bit. Dwayne gives me a call and says, hey, the owner has basically told me that you're doing some work. Can you come in for an interview?
Mm.
And I went in. I did not slam media play that time. I learned my lesson.
Smart.
But I talked to Dwayne for a few minutes, and it seemed like, I don't know if Dwayne knew what to think about me because I was like super fan who had been doing some work. But he liked me well enough, and he hired me. And so in November 1995, I started working for the Drexel.
I want to see this as a movie and have the and flashback to young, eager Joe.
I still remember my first night working there. I took tickets.
Like Jerry O'Connell coming off the bus in Joe's apartment.
Oh, well, here's
that's how I picture you.
Here's the fun thing. I was in so many ways because I'm sitting there tearing tickets because it's your first night. You don't know how to work concessions yet. And it was a fairly brisk night in terms of business. Jeff is there. Jeff is standing by me, just kind of saying hi to people, and I'm referring to Jeff as Mr. Frank at this point, Mr. Frank, can you tell me this, blah, 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 and I'm peppering him with marathon questions. I was like, Mr. Frank, who directed Gravity?
I was about to say, were you wearing a Jiminy Gravity outfit while you were doing
this? I should have been.
That's how I picture you.
I should have been.
In little, like, lederhosen overall thing.
I was such an unabashed, like, babe in the woods at that point. Because I knew nothing about how the business actually worked. And I considered this at the time to be, like, the greatest job you could ever have was just working, tearing tickets at the Drexels, you know?
Yeah.
You
were really stupid back then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a lot of good times there.
Oh, yeah.
Those years that I spent working there, I met so many cool people that I would that changed my life in a lot of ways. But at that point, I started working for them. So I was kind of on the inside. So we get around to January, February 1996.
Yeah.
And the idea gets floated, finally, that sci-fi is probably going to continue. We have talked about this a bit before.
Oh, no. You got inside track, and you wet yourself, didn't you?
It was great. Well, I was pushing for the horror marathon, because my dream...
Oh, well, because they skipped it. There was no horror marathon in the next year.
Yeah, yeah. 95, the only thing they did was a horror double feature Halloween night of The Bride with White Hair and Dr. Lamb.
That's obscure.
This was the beginning of the peak of that Hong Kong action, Hong Kong horror wave that was hitting in the mid-90s, where a lot of that stuff with the John Woo stuff finally hit the U.S. for distribution. And they wanted to do a Halloween double feature, and I guess they got a deal to do two Hong Kong horror-ish type movies.
Okay.
But no horror marathon. So they were talking about doing sci-fi in the spring, and it finally came up that the place they were able to get, and I think there were ideas peppered around of the normal places that you might do it at that point.
Yeah.
Like, I think maybe Mershon was considered at one point, Auditorium. There might have been one more place, and then the Capitol Theater in the Rife Center downtown. Mm. That's where they ended up settling on being able to do something. And so It was that was March 1996 that that happened. So this was like maybe mid-January 1996 that this starts becoming official. That sci-fi is going to come back. But, and this is where we'll have to do the short version of the story for those of you who didn't hear it before. Because it'll just go on and on if we don't.
Yeah.
The gimmick at the last sci-fi marathon at the Drexel North, like one of the big hooks was you, the audience, can vote for your 10 favorite sci-fi movies to be a part of next year's sci-fi marathon for the 10th one.
Oh, okay.
Because they always, I think they always wanted to do at least number 10 to like round it off and then see what happens past that. So at SF9 in 1995, you got a ballot and it had all of the movies that had shown at the sci-fi marathons before.
Okay.
And then a write-in spot for anything else you might want to screen. So you hit January 1996, and they kind of pared it down to, I think, six or seven of the ten. They didn't show 2001 and Day the Earth Stood Still, which both made the vote back then, because Studio 35 had just shown them not that long before.
Okay.
Literally like a month or so before, Studio showed those on a double feature.
Yeah.
There was one more two they didn't show, but the other films that showed, which I'm looking at your list, Alien, Forbidden Planet, Blade Runner, Brazil, War of the Worlds, and Aliens, those all were part of the voting of the top ten. But the big
hook, three of which ran at the last cycle.
Hey! Only 19 years later.
Yes.
So the plan was to run those, but as we mentioned in a previous podcast, I remember the day when Jeff was mulling over what to show. And he became convinced that they had to get Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, as a big premiere. In fact, he told me at that point that if he felt like if they could get that, they could make the marathon work.
Yeah.
If they couldn't get it, it might not work. Now, looking back, I don't know if that was true either way.
Yeah.
I think the marathon would have still continued no matter what. Obviously, it did.
I mean, Mystery Science Theater had some cachet back then, but I don't think it was a make or break thing.
No, no. But what happened was they booked the lineup, and the lineup is what is basically on the Hall of Marathonia list right now. But it had MST3K, the movie, top build.
Mm.
And this is where things get hazy again, because the original, there was an original larger teaser flyer that got sent out to the mailing list that had the lineup. And then it had a note on the back to those of you who are the marathon faithful saying, look, we really need you this year to tell a friend about the marathon, because this is a big transition. This was not included on the regular flyers. If you have that original larger than life, like 11 by 17 flyer, it is larger than life in some ways.
It was 7 feet by 12.
It was huge. You could really sleep in it. If you have that original flyer, you'll see that it says world premiere, Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie. No one really batted an eyelash at that point because of that. Until, apparently, you, Kevin Carr, ruined the whole thing and sent the marathon spiraling down into oblivion by getting on Gramercy's, listserv at that point, saying, LOL.
It was on the AOL message board for MST.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, again, I'm still unclear whether I was the one who set that emotion or if...
No, I think
somebody else set that emotion, and my post came kind of after that and just made a little more noise.
Yeah, no, there was some miscommunication somewhere in the whole thing.
Because I think my post was just, they're showing MST.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. And then everything fell apart.
Yeah, it was a weird situation. And the only person who could probably tell you the very specifics of what happened would be Jeff. But he's not here today.
No.
But the miscommunication happened at some point. I'm fairly sure that they did arrange a screening. I don't think it went to the flyer, and there was no talk. I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Drexel just saying, put it on the flyer, we've got it, who cares, without checking. But somewhere along the line, there was miscommunication about what it was.
I think you had said last time we talked about that, it was Gramercy who said, it wasn't Best Brains that had a problem. It was Gramercy taking issue with it saying world premiere.
Because by the time the real flyer came out,
the
one distributed to the general public.
Is that the one that came in the mail?
Yeah, that was the one that came probably later in the mail.
Okay.
The official flyer that was green and black ink on white, that had MST3K, the movie, but it very clearly had the notation of what kind of premiere it was, whited out or blacked out. It just said premiere. It was like a last minute thing. You could tell, like, we got to change this right before it hits the printer. Yeah. So at that point, it still looked like it was going to happen.
Yeah.
I remember about a week after that flyer came out, I'm at work, and one of the guys I was working with comes up to me and says, "Have you heard the news?" I said, "What news?" He says, "Jeff lost MST3K the movie." And in my head, it was like, oh no, this could be disastrous.
Because you told you that the world will end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, it turned out to be fine. And
yeah,
was,
I mean, what's funny is, even though it was disappointing and it was a big deal, I don't recall there being gnashing of teeth and lamenting at the doors for this.
Not
that
at all.
MST was
in fact, that was the beautiful thing about that marathon, was once we finally got to it, and it was City of Lost Children, Tremors 2, and Cemetery Man as premieres. Pretty good slate of premieres.
Those are good premieres.
In fact, I would hazard to say, heretic speaking here, those all are way better premieres than MST3K the movie. And I like MST3K the movie.
Well, what's funny is I remember then going to see MST3K the movie when it opened at the Drexel Grandview, because I think Grandview was still under the Drexel.
You're right.
At the time. We went to see it later that summer, and we were just kind of disappointed in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And here's why. Because they edited the movie down, so it was like 75 minutes. The entirety of the movie
Was Silent 75 Earth, minutes.
Because they cut this Island Earth down so much.
Yeah.
And it just didn't have the same oomph. They spent so much money on the sets to make shitty sets look like big shitty sets.
Yeah.
And they didn't have much of a wraparound story.
Not really.
And it didn't... It was in no way reaching out to bring in anybody else who had not been already a fan of the show.
No, it was an extended episode.
Yeah.
That was about it.
It wasn't even that. It was shorter.
You're right. Yeah. Shorter than that.
Than an actual episode of the TV show.
And I like that movie.
Yeah, it's not bad.
But I don't... It's
not
clearly
their strongest piece of work. But it's funny, I saw the live show. I've seen I went to the MST, as what a geek I was. I went to the MST convention when they were trying to get the movie made, trying to get Universal to bite on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the MST Live or whatever they called it. I think it was just MST3K Live. And they did it live on stage with the robots and on the wings and everything. And then they showed the movie. And that thing went over like gangbusters to a room of 2,000 fans. Sure. Yeah. But so you're right. I think it was probably better than Tremors 2.
But Tremors 2 with that crowd was great.
Yeah. If you're going to see Tremors 2, that's the way to
see it. That was the thing, and people today might not realize it, but for that year, not quite a year, but almost a year, when there was such trepidation amongst a lot of people who loved the marathons if they were going to continue, for the event to just happen was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget the exact number of attendees that year, but I'm pretty sure it was still close to about 600 people showing up at the Capitol Theater.
It was pretty full.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't, seem weirdly empty.
And you could tell there was a real sense of excitement. I still remember standing in line, and the line is stretching all the way back to the elevators in the lobby of the Capitol Theater.
Yeah.
And it's the old crew, and it's most of the people who still wanted to do this are still there. I have a vivid memory of walking into the theater. I'd never been in the Capitol Theater before that day. And, you know, it's like the music's playing and it's the Star Wars theme and you look around and that place is huge and cavernous and it's got a balcony. And it's like, I just remember thinking, oh my God, it's actually happening. Because once the Drexel North was gone, it was like, there's no way in hell this is going to happen again. So just to have it was I mean, amazing is the only word I can use. And the excitement in the air at that point and in that time of marathon history was like, maybe this will work. Maybe this will actually keep going on.
There are some odd things about the... Because you couldn't bring food.
Well, I was going to say, do you want to talk about the limitations of the place first or just memories of that actual event?
No, let's hit the limitations. Okay, from this point forward, my memories aren't as thick as the ones in...
Well, mine are, kid. Let me tell you.
I'm just saying because at this point, I was... I wasn't even married at this point. I was engaged and I was going to get married that year. And so once I got married and I had a real job and I was paying taxes and all that awful stuff you have to do, my marathon attendance waned a bit. So I don't have as much.
So I have to fill in the bulk of the stories now.
Well, only so much.
So, okay. Let's talk about the limitations first. Yeah.
No food. That was a big one.
Well, that's the... Well, see, okay, you've never learned anything from radio, have you? You have to build up to the biggest limitation. You have to tease the smaller limitations and then say, and, but above all of those, yeah. And you just shot...
Oh, I would, I just... I thought you, I'd leave that because that's what... That was the big thing everybody noticed.
You just blew your wad right there, that's going straight to no food. That well is what I do. Done. Well
that was,
done.
That was my... That was my... That was my nickname. No. Okay, go
okay,
on.
So,
you
want to
start
okay.
with something less? Forget I said that.
Yeah,
rewind.
Everybody, rewind and just delete that.
Okay, let's start
well,
this off slow.
First of all, the Capitol Theater is not set up to show movies on a regular basis. Mm. So they had to rent all the equipment.
Oh, really?
They had to rent the film projectors. They had to rent the screen. They had to have...
They show stuff all the time, though, don't they now? I mean, not all the time, but they show stuff, period. I mean, usually it's ballet and stuff, but... I've seen other movies.
I've seen other movies there, too, but the only ones I've ever seen are usually if they have a special one-time-only setup for a show.
Yeah, I did like The Wizard of Oz.
When they were doing construction on the Ohio Theater back in summer, I think summer 96 or summer 97, they did the summer film series there.
Yeah.
I saw The Godfather there on film for the first time, but they had to rent the stuff from that, too.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a projection booth, but you had to rent the equipment to bring in, so that was not... cheap,
no,
as you can probably tell.
Oh, yeah.
You also, with the Capitol Theater, were beholden to Kappa's schedule. Mm. It's weird, because now Kappa runs the Drexel, essentially.
Well, yeah, yeah.
But back then, you had to adhere to their schedule, which is why the dates for the marathon varied each year it was there.
Yeah.
Because if they had something that was booked a year in advance, you couldn't just go in and say, I'm coming in March, no matter what.
You can't just kick out the Russian ballet.
Unfortunately not, no. Sorry,
the
Russians.
Russian ballet kicks you.
They do. Yeah. So that was a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest one, like you said, when you forgot, you didn't... You have
well,
to,
there are two, because there's another one.
Which is the other one
the
you're
seats.
Thinking of.
The seats are not the most comfortable.
Seats were not the most comfortable.
They're like... Well, the thing is, they're wooden seats, so they feel a little bit like bleachers.
Yep, a little...
But
that's probably going a little.
It's going
far.
A little far.
There's
but
padding on them.
Padding, but it's like they're like wooden sides. I mean, it's not... Yeah. But they're fine to go see a 3-hour performance, but spending 24 hours in them is...
Let's look at the grand history of the marathons. Drexel North seats, I still have one. I sit in it all the time. Not the most comfortable.
But they're not theater
Studio seats. 35, where we did the marathon for 5 years. Are you kidding me? I love the studio marathons. We'll talk about them next time. I'm glad I never had to sit through a studio marathon, because those seats, when I did it there, were terrible.
They're rough, but there's traditional theater seats.
Yeah,
you get used to that. I mean, the Rife Center seats are comfortable, but they're just there. I don't know. They're different.
Here's my recollection. They weren't ideal.
No.
However, if it was between not doing the marathon and doing it with those seats, those were perfectly acceptable.
I'm not saying that was a deal breaker. I went to them.
I don't think that was like a huge limitation, though.
Okay.
Of big limitations, it was logistical. The cost to rent the place, the cost to rent the equipment, and... Now we're paying off on the half-assed tease that I tried to reestablish. I sound like a radio super fan now. Like, I'm like, I know more about radio than you do. Please, I listen to radio all the time. I've learned a lot. This is how I got to run marathons.
There you are.
Yeah. The no food option. That was a killer. That was a huge killer. You could not eat inside the theater. Now, people snuck things in.
Yeah, but you couldn't. That was also back in the day when people would bring in coolers.
You went from basically at the North the final year being able to bring in coolers and whatever you wanted. For the most part, whatever you wanted.
I remember somebody in the North actually bought a ticket for their cooler.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We have that person on video.
Mm-hmm.
They bought a child's ticket, I think, for the cooler, if I remember correctly.
Well, because the cooler is probably less than 8 years old or something.
Yeah.
But you couldn't bring in food. And it wasn't. See, it wasn't just that there were. The concessions were not the concessions at the Drexel North were fantastic.
Yeah.
But
they were more limited.
They were more limited, but also downtown Columbus, and it might be a little different now, but back then it shut down in the weekends.
Here was the pitch that was given when we went there. It was okay, you can't have food inside the actual theater in the screening room.
Yeah.
But we'll have the concession stand slightly expanded. We have a huge lobby area, so if you want to bring food, just, you know, keep it in your car, bring it into the lobby, eat it there, and then go back in the theater. Or visit one of the... I mean, there were some places downtown you could go eat. It was nowhere near as expansive as it is now.
There was City Center, which was in walking distance.
Food court.
But the problem was, is on the weekends, it was severely... It was... Because it was downtown, it rolled up shop at like 5 or 6. I mean, Everything shut down then. So pretty much once you got to about 6 o'clock, you were limited to concession stands. Whereas like in
That's
the
not
north,
completely true. There were like some places to eat downtown. There weren't a lot.
Not really. I mean... Like easy and quick.
Easy and quick. That's what I'm talking about.
When you're at the Grandview, there were plenty of shops, restaurants, and bars down the street at the Drexel.
Let's set a definition. When you say no place to eat, that is not a place. Yeah.
No. What I'm saying is, if you're going to run out in a movie, if you want to sit down, and like, I'll give you a great example. Drexel East. You want something to eat at 8 o'clock, you get up, you walk down, Cozy's is right there, reasonably priced, and it's relatively
quick.
There
weren't places like that. You would have to shell out a little bit of money.
You'd have to sit down and be waited on and take an hour and a half to eat. Yeah. That's the difference.
But, yeah.
But even then...
People are going to listen to this and say, who cares? Just get on with it.
But it does. It did make a difference, because I would drag people to this thing, and it was like, well, if you wanted to go sit down and have a nice dinner downtown, yeah, you could. But if you just wanted to pop out and have a bite,
that was the problem.
You had to do it, or you had to walk, and then that's it. That was your only option, because they didn't really open up until like what, maybe 10 o'clock.
Or you had
Sunday
to walk
morning,
up to the convention center,
which is a hell of a walk.
Which was a big walk, and the food court's there, but that's different.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was a big, big limitation. I've told the story before, but they had coffee mugs that year again, new coffee mugs with the refill, and. Once
bring them in the theater.
No, well, that was the thing. Once you hit like 1 a.m, I remember here was my schedule. The end credits to the film would hit. Literally, right as the end credits hit, I would spring out of my seat with the coffee cup, run out the door, go to the concession stand, get my refill, chug coffee for 5 minutes, and then sprint back into the theater to make it for the next film.
Slush.
Which was kind of fun in a very demented adrenaline rush way, but that first year, it wasn't that big of a deal, seemingly, because it was happening.
Yeah, no,
that was the thing.
Right.
And there was no...
You're like, this is the big restriction, but don't dump on it too much.
Well, no, it's not even don't dump on it, because that's a big restriction. But I think the crowd energy that first year was still very strong, because they thought, look, we're doing it this year, let's see what happens after this. The problem, and this gets underrated in why things changed over time. The problem was, once you hit the second year, is that they had to do it in January, Super Bowl weekend.
Yeah.
That was earlier than it had ever happened before. And for various reasons, the promotion for the event got held off way too late. You didn't really get the full lineup. And back then, you needed the full lineup on a flyer and a press release. That didn't come out until like... end of November, beginning of December. Actually, no, I take that back. The actual flyer for the event only came out maybe 2-3 weeks before the actual marathon.
Oh, so it was very much like it was a couple years ago.
In some ways, yeah. That, to me, is what really led to the attendance drop in year two, which went down, I think, to about 400, maybe 450.
I did not go that year.
Yeah.
I did not go. And the reason I didn't go, this was, again, one of those times where I just gotten married. I mean, like, literally... I'd been married.
Make the whole thing about you, Kevin.
See, here's the thing: because you get married, and getting married is expensive because you're doing stuff.
That's your own fault.
A big thing. And then we went on our honeymoon, which is expensive. And we got back within a week of getting back from our honeymoon. I got into what? Okay, yeah. I'm pausing to see the break. Yeah, I hear you. Okay. I was, right after we got married and we got back from our honeymoon, I got in a car accident that almost totaled my car. And then my wife, on her way to pick me up, got hit by somebody, which totaled her car.
That's terrible.
Two car accidents within an hour. So that was expensive because you had deductibles and everything. And so we come up to the marathon and we're trying to pay off debt and we're looking at, and I just couldn't afford the price at that time.
Yeah.
And it's not that it was ridiculously expensive. No one really wanted to go with me. There wasn't a lot of the lineup, it's a good lineup, but it wasn't something that I was dying to see.
Mm.
So
I think in the history of the Rife Center marathons, it's easy just to look at the no food thing as being a killer, but I think it was a combination of things that ended up eating into the attendance.
There's a lot. It was also location, getting downtown, parking downtown.
Not as easy as you'd think, yeah.
Yeah. And this is not me digging on it. This is me saying
No.
Huge difference in I mean, it, and
oh, I'm as, trust me, yeah. I'm as openly critical as anyone for that.
But I mean, it's not me, I mean, I'd love, I mean, I'd go back if that's what it was, yeah. You know, but yeah. It was a very different, you know, there was still the energy there after that first year, but I do think putting it in January messed it up quite a bit.
That was a difficult one. Well, the 96 one was really great with the lineup that they had. Do you remember this? The one of the big features of the 96 Sci-Fi was showing the sizzle reel from Independence Day.
I remember that. Yeah. And they showed the sizzle reel for the re-release of Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah. Yeah, that was a huge attraction for that year. And there was the promise that better days were ahead. And there was still, you know, the movie environment of 1996 was different too, because this was pre-DVD still, you remember. And that still held a very big appeal to seeing these movies in a theater
on a VHS. Yeah. Nobody had widescreen TV. No. The other thing is, it was before when you have these what let's just call them transitional years. Mm-hmm. These transitional years happened while the internet was kind of coming on.
Yeah,
up to speed.
Very much so.
And so it wasn't just, and the internet had such, over the last 15 years, the internet has had a devastating impact, even though it makes it accessible on bulletin boards to put the line up and the communications easier. Not only before you were dealing with streaming and torrenting and just being able to watch stuff availability on a wide big screen TV,
yeah,
you could then order stuff easier.
Yeah.
Like you were talking about getting these Japanese import.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You don't have to do that anymore. No.
Yeah. That was all like in catalogs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you got in the early 2000s, you could, the eBay was there. You could find a lot more stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you were into obscure stuff, it wasn't as rare.
People still have a desire, as shown by all the marathons that happen around the country. People still have a desire to go to these.
Oh, sure.
It's just, It's a little harder to entice people to come out because of the home video internet
and that's
revolution.
That's where the internet has really dug in. I mean, it's been good too because it helps. We wouldn't have the show.
Yeah. Do you still have pull SF10 back up for a second here? I'm just trying to see if there's any other big memories that stand out. Oh, another limitation too was for the 3 years at the Rife Center, unless I'm completely off my rocker, they were kind of limited to having mono sound. Which does kind of take away from some of the movies and makes it a little more crowded. Not that I think most people notice, but even I noticed when I was watching some of these that it seemed weird. Like the screen was nice. The temporary screen they set up was nice, but the sound always seemed a little bit off.
Well, I never noticed that actually. And I usually could notice good quality stereo soundtrack versus mono but because it wasn't a regular movie theater.
Yeah.
It was not designed for movies.
That is true.
The sound always was a little bit weird.
Yeah.
You know? Even for stuff like when they did Rocket Ship XM.
Oh, yeah, yeah. SF10 was the first time I'd ever seen Forbidden Planet, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Which was fantastic. Yeah. Let's see. You hit SF11.
Yeah.
Here's the timeline of what happened. This was the first and only time I sat in on a marathon planning meeting at the Drexel.
Yeah.
They used to have a meeting where it would be Bruce and Jeff and four or five other guys who had kind of helped out over the years. The brain trust, the mythical brain trust, which you can read about in old programs. And I always thought, wow, this would be a great idea to go in and sit and you know, run through ideas. In practice, it was a little less effective. It was more like a, you know, giant brainstorming that often didn't lead to many places.
Yeah.
But I went to that, and that was probably beginning of November that we did that. And then for one reason or another, things just kind of got gummed up, mainly because it's in end of January, the holidays hit. And there's no announcement, and there's no announcement, and there's no announcement, and finally tickets go on sale, but there's no lineup, and back then that was kind of disastrous.
This is for the 11th?
For the 11th. And
oh, yeah, not having a lineup tends to
yeah.
cause a problem.
And so finally, it was like 2 or 3 weeks beforehand, the flyer comes out finally. But it's a little late in the game for this whole thing at that point. I think this is a fantastic lineup. This is one of my favorite lineups, and if I could go back and do it again, I would love to go back and watch this lineup again because I don't think I appreciated it enough in its time. Yeah. This was the first year that I got to work with Bruce in any way. Hmm. Back then, I was still such a huge fanboy of the marathons that Bruce to me was like this godlike figure that I just didn't want to piss off. Hmm. I remember I took a film class in the Wexner Center back in spring 1996, and Bruce is the projectionist there. And it was right after SF10, there was an alien mating call contest at SF10. I entered it, and Bruce joked around with me on stage. He's like, oh, it's not like you couldn't just go upstairs in the office and get one of these prizes if you wanted to. The next Monday, I saw him in the film class, and on my way out, I saw him. I said, hey, I hope you didn't think I was, you know, like I hope I didn't, like, make you mad for entering the contest, even though I work for the theater. And Bruce is like, oh, no, I was just kidding. Come on, it's okay. But I didn't know him hardly at all at that point.
You felt like a shill.
I did, yeah. He only knew me as that guy. That kid who
that
goes to the
marathons. That crazy, insane,
that crazy, mixed up, wacky Dr. Zombie.
Don't mention marathons.
So, this would have been, like, December 96. He comes into the theater one day and says, hey, you should help out with this. Here's what I want to do. And his idea was he wanted to do tie in with the Super Bowl weekend when they used to announce the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes winner.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to do something like that. And his idea was we'll do some kind of Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes ripoff thing throughout the event where you have to keep submitting a ballot like 3 or 4 times through the event, and we'll do a drawing at the end for the people who submit the last round.
Oh, my God, this is so complicated.
It is. It was very complicated. And that person will win something. Why don't you help me come up with whatever we do? And it was weird because it was like him asking me to come up with some ideas, but I was gun-shy because it was obviously his idea.
Yeah.
And the first idea I came up with was, oh, you get to program a film for next year. And he was reluctant to do that. He was thinking, well, but, you know, that could run into a lot of limitations. And then I said, well, why don't we have you get a free ticket for next year? He was amenable to that. And I forget what else we gave away. It kind of, in the end, I think the way it played out was kind of like a somewhat of an in-joke that some of the people got.
Yeah.
Not everybody got. There's a picture somewhere, I think it's on the online archives, of him giving the winner the free stuff and me standing right behind him. But
Were you in a house dress holding up Publishers Clearinghouse?
I only wish I could have been, yeah. Well, we didn't have a big check.
Did you have a fat guy with glasses?
No, well, Bruce was I don't know what to say. It was kind of weird in the end because I felt at some point like, Bruce, this is your idea. I wouldn't have said this at the time, but I've told him this since. It was like, Bruce, this was your idea. Run with it. I'm glad you want me to be involved, but it's your idea. Yeah. You know, I'm just kind of around here. But that was the first time that he and I ever officially worked on anything together.
Hmm.
And that was a step in the right direction, I think, or the wrong direction.
You know, one of the again, looking at the schedule, the timing of this part, and this probably also played in it with me, having a late January thing for an event this size. At least I know the way my life is now. I hit October. I'm very busy
completely
in October.
Completely disheveled.
Well, I'm very busy in October. Very busy in November. Because, and for me, it's because I got award season coming up. But I got kids. They're in school. My wife teaches. And then you hit, and December is just a whirlwind. From, I like how you set the mic right next to it so you could hear it, crinkle, crinkle. You're trying to be so discreet and you set it right next to the mic.
I didn't know how far the throw was on this thing.
So,
I don't want to pass out.
Yeah. But for me, it's kind of like, I can't think, if I'm in December, I can't plan for January. Because it's not until I get after Christmas, and I'm in that week between Christmas and New Year's, that I can finally get my ducks in a row and say, oh, okay, Christmas is done, whatever. And I don't know if other people experience that with just their own personal lives.
You know what? I think this whole thing is called Marathon Chat, not Kevin Carr's Life Chat.
Oh, my
it?
Gosh. Right? Man.
Members of the audience right now are saying, I don't care about Kevin's life. I want to hear inside dirt on the marathons.
Instead of Joe eating almonds.
I did attend the third one of the Rife Center.
We're not done talking about SF 11. Oh, my God. Come on. I know you want to talk about your life and fast forward to the next one. Come on now. Anyway, it's notable if you look at SF 11 that there is the first trailer-thon block.
Yes.
Okay, because the idea was at SF 10, because there was no food allowed in the theater, that there might be a block of trailers shown twice. Was the original pitch.
Okay. So you could go out and get something to eat during
SF 11 then, Bruce made it official and did like, I think it was like an hour-long block of trailers. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to go eat during that without missing anything, any feature films, you could do that. It was a Time Warp trailer-thon in mm-hmm. total, which was supposed to be a teaser for what he wanted to do later, which was a Time Warp theme marathon. But that's why that's right smack dab in the middle of that marathon. It's not just, hey, let's show a bunch of trailers for the hell of it. It's, here is supposed to be something where if you want to leave for a half hour and get something to eat, you can go do that. This marathon, I think, is kind of great in some ways because there's a real variety to the lineup.
Yeah.
Altered States played for the first and only time so far, a movie which I totally love. One of only two Ken Russell films to ever show at a marathon. Well, and seeing it in a theater like that and in a setting like that was kind of special, to say the very least. The bookends of The Fly and The Fly, I think,
well, that's a good one.
Is pretty strong.
And what people don't realize is The Fly, David Cronenberg's The Fly, was only about 10 years old at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Barbarella, I think, looking back for your insider info, Barbarella was one of the first films considered for that marathon, I remember. There was a new print of it out. And I could be wrong. Nah, that's not one of the ones Boston played. Over the years, there have been a number of times where our mothership marathon in Boston that spawned this illegitimate enterprise here in Columbus, where they have played certain things, and knowing that they could play certain things enabled us to play certain things. So that's why some years you'll see like a big overlap between those two marathons. Something's available for the Boston. Let's grab it now while we still can. The 97 one, let me think. Any other memories about that in terms of stuff? Gort is the Hall of Fame inductee. Invasion of the Saucer Men is bumped because of time constraints. Mm-hmm. To this day, has never played. Mm-hmm. Frank Gorshin fans everywhere are probably crestfallen.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that sci-fi marathon is, I think, still really good and kind of an interesting one in the mid-ground. But the cracks are starting to show in the organizational aspects of it. And it's the date, and it's whatever calendar problems happen for Kevin and the extended car universe.
I'm just saying that my experiences are probably not typical.
No, here's what I think. If you were gonna do that event in 1997 in January, then you had to get promo out at least 3 months beforehand.
Well, yeah, because you had to cut through all the Christmas noise.
Yeah.
Holiday noise.
And it didn't. And that's kind of what happened with that. Which then leads to 1998, which would be the last marathon at the Rife Center. And that's a weird year. That was for the first time when Bruce didn't do the flyer for the marathon.
Oh, really?
Someone in-house at the Drexel did.
Oh, and but there was one.
You can really tell the difference. In fact, he had people come up to him before the marathon and at the marathon and say, we were kind of worried like that you weren't involved anymore because mm-hmm. the flyer looks so radically different. And it does. And the lineup is okay. And at that point, I think that you were getting the cracks with trying to schedule the Rife Center and other things going on. And it's not a very strong lineup in total. There's like several films that are much newer.
It's a good lineup, but like Mars Attacks, Gattaca, and Starship Troopers, while I like all three of those, those were like just out in the theaters. Yeah. And doing one is fine, but doing three that are like a year or so old.
And that was around the time when Boston played all three of those.
Yeah.
And it seemed like that was kind of the
way
to
go. Then you also had Stargate. It ended with Stargate, which was only 4 years before that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the eclectic mix was not as strong that year. However, we did that year have the live appearance by David Wechter, Michael Nankin, and Michelle Stacy with Gravity, which tied in with a little event called Gravity Live, which we've talked about before.
Starring Joan F.
Starring me and my cast of friends, enablers, co-conspirators, all that stuff. That was, it's weird when I think back to that marathon on a personal note. So much of that marathon was taken up by Gravity Live for me that I missed out on several films. Yeah. I missed out on Inframan, missed out on Space Truckers.
I actually went to
fell asleep afterwards.
We went to find somewhere to get something to eat around Inframan.
Yeah.
But Space Truckers was okay. That was Stuart Gordon, wasn't it?
That it was.
Yeah, it was not Stuart Gordon's strongest. We'll just say that.
I've still never seen it.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's funny for what it is, but it's on that waning edge from his sort of his heyday in doing the Lovecraft stuff. And even like Pit in the Pendulum and stuff like that.
Yeah, then yeah, yeah.
He's gone down and he's really fallen into camp at that point.
There's still a real, at the time especially, there was still a real appeal to getting any new Stuart Gordon film because he was not that far away from that peak,
yeah,
from the commercial peak.
Oh, yeah.
That marathon, attendance finally, I believe, dipped below 400 at that point. And well, there was a real sense that there were some problems going on.
Well, there's also the replay, Earth Girls Are Easy, the print didn't show up.
The famous story, if you didn't hear it at Sci-Fi this year, was that they booked Earth Girls Are Easy, and the first three reels of the print showed up, but not the last two. Yeah. When this was discovered, Jeff and Bruce got up in front of the audience, this was earlier in the event, and said, hey, a couple options we can do. Number one is we can show Earth Girls Are Easy, the first three reels. Then we can rent a big screen TV, put it in the lobby. I know this sounds kind of ridiculous. Put it in the lobby and show the last, what would be half hour, 40 minutes on Laserdisc. And all of you that are still here can congregate in the lobby and watch this on a big screen TV. The audience was not that pumped up for that option. So option number two was, we can also show another film that we have on hand in its entirety. And that other film became infamous because it had only shown 3 years beforehand, because that other film that they ended up showing in the place of Earth Girls Are Easy was Them! Giant Ant Epic, which also replaced Rocket Ship XM at SF9 at the Drexel North. And to this day, there are people who remember Them as, oh God, not Them again, that giant ant movie that keeps showing over and over again, even though it's only shown twice at the Columbus Sci-Fi Marathon. So that showed instead of Earth Girls Are Easy, and that probably maybe, you know, made the lineup seem a little odd anyway as it was. But it just, you know, at that point, in terms of the entire lineup, it wasn't as strong as a lineup, and it was getting more and more difficult to book the Rife Center. And that led to, you know, leaving the Rife Center ultimately and looking for another place. And it's strange because it felt, at least to me, it felt like the end of the Rife Center era in most ways. It felt like, okay, you got to go do something else because this isn't working anymore.
There are a couple bumps in the road, yeah, and they necessitated going somewhere else.
Now, it's around this time, too, that something different starts, and that is in fall 1997, I do my final video horror marathon. And I'm actually excited at this point because back then they were finally coming out with Letterbox tapes. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Gray hair is really showing right now. I specifically remember, and some of you will laugh at this, I specifically remember getting really excited because I had just bought a Letterbox tape of The Hunger, which everybody knows I watch along with Suspiria on a loop all the time, constantly, 24/7. And I was excited to show that the next year. But I did my video horror marathon September 1997. 2 weeks afterwards, my friend Tim, who was managing the Drexel Grandview at the time, who some of you know from his other exploits and being a longtime supporter of this illegitimate, ill-gotten enterprise, Tim is managing the Grandview, and he comes to me and says, hey, Jeff has Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Next Generation, the infamous one with Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger.
McConaughey.
Not that bad of a film, I'm telling you.
Oh, no.
Underrated in some ways.
Absolute shit.
That's for another podcast. Jeff has Texas Chainsaw The Next Generation. He wants me to put together like a double feature that night on Halloween night 1997. So we should do this. And I said, well, why don't we try for something more? So Tim and Mark Hoik, who was working at the Drexel at the time, longtime employee, who would 3 years from then be on Beat the Geeks, have his moment of fame in Comedy Central. Yeah, you know, Mark lives in L.A. to this day, does a lot of stuff with local companies, DVD companies. He's done audio commentaries for things. If you ever have the Candy Snatchers DVD, he's the moderator for the audio commentary. Tim, Mark, and I get together at Tim's house, and we try to figure out how we can extend this event as much as we can. We come up with the idea to say, hey, why don't we try to pitch four films? And we'll do like a quasi all-nighter. Do four films and a bunch of trailers and shorts and other stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the idea we agree on is we want to do Texas Chainsaw the Next Generation. You could tell we're complete hucksters because we're like, we're given these limit. It's like the Roger Corman School of Film Booking. You have to play Texas Chainsaw Massacre the Next Generation. Okay, cool. We'll play that, but we're going to put the other shit we want to play on top of it. Our original lineup we pitched was Texas Chainsaw the Next Generation, The Tingler, Eraserhead, and Dawn of the Dead. And
of course, Dawn of the Dead.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, and
of course.
God, yeah, you talk like
and
like,
the Hunger and Suspiria.
You talk about Dawn of the Dead like it was some weird, obscure film no one likes. We took that to Jeff. Jeff said we can't get Dawn of the Dead, which was true because the Richard Rubenstein, the producer, to this day still has the rights to it, and he did not want to distribute it theatrically at that point. For reasons which we'll go into maybe some other day. So he said, we have to get something else. And knowing Brian Usna as we did, and I think Usna was still in the U.S. at that point, said, why don't we show Reanimator instead?
Yeah.
So the final lineup for what became Shocktoberfest, that was my title I gave to the event,
yeah,
was Reanimator, The Tingler, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, and Eraserhead. Shocktoberfest, the reason we named it that, I will take credit for this, but I ripped it off.
It's because it rhymes with Oktoberfest?
Hey! You're good. In Hoot Magazine, which we've talked about before, I remember reading about the 1992 Night of the Living Drexel Horror Marathon, and Irv Oslin's article said, led off with saying, it's Shocktober again at the Drexel North, where Bruce Bartu and Jeff Frank are doing blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have a generic name that doesn't necessarily tie it into Night of the Living whatever Drexel or whatever,
yeah,
and just call it that. So we did Shocktoberfest, Halloween night, 1997. Pretty good crowd. I think, if I remember, we had like 170, 180 people.
That's not bad.
No, not at all. And this was only like $10 in advance, 12 at the door. Eraserhead, I think, was a pretty big draw. That was the first time Eraserhead had played in Columbus in quite a long time.
Yeah.
And generally, things went over pretty well, with the exception of Reanimator did not show because it was prominently featured. The biggest art on the whole on the flyer was Reanimator. Reanimator, the print got lost in Europe. It was supposed to come to the States, and someone couldn't find it. So we ended up playing Army of Darkness instead. Here's the problem. We didn't tell people it was Army of Darkness until it unspooled. So
that would have pissed me off.
So we showed The Tingler first, and we couldn't do regular Percepto. Is it Percepto with The Tingler? Emergo is House on Haunted Hill.
I think it is Percepto.
It is Percepto. We couldn't do the real Percepto, so we did this weird bastardized version where. It's a long story. It worked out okay. Tim will probably hate me for saying it worked out okay because it was his idea of what to do. It involved like snakes in cans and people fainting and things like that. People had a good time with that.
Yeah.
Tim will be happy with me for saying this, that during Texas Chainsaw Massacre Next Generation, Tim worked in a gimmick where his nephew or cousin, Willie, dressed up in a hooded robe, like a, you know, like what do you call that? Like a monk, like a Knights Templar
Jedi
type thing, yeah. And got a chainsaw, took the teeth off of the chainsaw.
Good, that's a good smart thing.
Positioned himself outside the rear theater door at the Grandview, and at a particularly dull moment in the film, cranked up the chainsaw. They opened the door, and he ran up the aisle in the theater with his chainsaw. Completely shocking the hell out of the crowd, which was like a really cool moment at that point. Probably something we couldn't get away with today. and that was a cool idea. It was something neat to like inject some life into that that film, which the audience wasn't that crazy about. Yeah. Then we showed Eraserhead. And then at the beginning of the event, we had debated on who should host this. And we said, why don't we just get Bruce to host it? Yeah. Everybody knows him anyway. Let's get him to do that. So we bring Bruce in. He doesn't know that much about what's going on because he literally comes in the night of. We're like, just go and say some stuff, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, because that always works.
Yeah.
Bruce, we told him not to say what the final film was, what we were replacing Reanimator with. He just told the crowd, Reanimator is lost in Europe, but we have a replacement film of commensurate value. I remember those words so dearly, of commensurate value. To Reanimator. And so at the end of the night, the final film is about to unspool. It hits the screen. It's Army of Darkness. And like a third of the people who are still there walked out at that point. They're like, yeah. I don't want to see Army of Darkness again. But here's the thing. The event itself was fun, and it was the first time any of us had really put together an event on our own like that. And it had this ramshackle fun to it. That night, I told my friends, this is the last marathon I'm ever planning.
Yeah, that's not true.
Because then I became manager of the theater the next year. And immediately, it's like, we're going to do a horror marathon. Now, here's a story that I might not have told that much in the past, publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Summer 1998, I'm the manager of the theater. And I'm convinced at this point, I have the power. I'm going to bring back the 24-hour horror marathon that fall. I run the place. I know how to do this, blah, blah, blah. So I did some really hardcore research that summer. I made phone calls to studio representatives. I got quotes on film rental prices. I had a meeting. I tried my own brain trust meeting where I had like five of my friends who went to the marathons, and we met at one of their houses and tried to brainstorm stuff and had like a big sheet of butcher paper on the back of the front door and wrote ideas down on it and everything. Before I finally kind of abandoned a lot of that and just went on my own, which is what you always should do.
Yeah.
Hello. So I scheduled a meeting in August 1998 with Jeff. And I brought a budget and a list of films that I said, here's what we should book. And had it down to, here's how much we charge. Here's how the profit we'll make. Here's where we'll go with this. Scheduled a meeting with him. Granted, did not tell him what this meeting was about beforehand.
Okay.
Because I was like, I'll surprise him, you know?
He'll love it. People love surprises.
I sat down, and I don't think he would mind me telling the story. I sat down, I showed him the list, I like ran through part of it with him, and then he said, we just can't do it. And I remember there was a moment where I just locked eyes with him, and I didn't quite know what I was going to say because I was really pissed off. And then I just kind of said, okay. And he said, but we should do the all-nighter still. I said, okay, that's cool. So we went full bore ahead and planned the second Shocktoberfest, the Bride of Shocktoberfest. Now, by this point, Tim had moved on to work at the Marcus Cinemas in Pickerington.
Mm-hmm.
Mark was still in town. But it was basically me running it with Jeff. And this was the first time I had ever really shepherded a horror marathon of any length on my own for a real paying audience.
Yeah,
And
I went to this one.
Yeah, this was like a kind of a highlight of my life at that point, because it felt official, it felt real. Black Sunday, Reanimator, the Ohio premiere of The Ugly.
That's an underrated film.
Yeah, that was a good premiere. I went back and finally watched that for the first time this winter. Found like a DVD copy for $5 at Half Price Books, and it's like a very unheralded premiere in the history of the events.
I don't think I stayed for this whole thing. I stayed through Last House on the Left.
Last House on the Left.
I was there with. I moved through people I went to these things with, and I was there with Joe Caroni.
Joe Caroni, I remember
who's
Joe.
I met you through Star Wars artist.
Yeah.
Very well known now. But Joe and I sat there, and we had some fun with Last House on the Left.
Last House on the Left was, before the end of it, Jeff came up to me and said, you have to make this announcement about a concession discount at the next break.
Yeah.
And this was so priceless, because at the end of Last House on the Left, as the credits start rolling, I've gone down to the front of the theater. I pick up the microphone, and right as the credits start rolling, I said, this just in, hot dogs are now half off at the concession stand.
Oh, wow.
And I don't even think Jeff had ever seen that movie, because he wouldn't have understood why that was such a great joke for
That was a coinky dink?
It was a coinky dink, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. But the crowd groans audibly at that point.
I do remember that.
Six String Samurai replaced the as still unseen Kung Fu Cannibals, a.k.a. Raw Force, which we've tried to play a couple times.
I think I got through about half of Six Screen Samurai, and then I was too tired and I left.
And then The Hunger,
which I'd seen before.
My favorite.
Yeah.
And then Evil Dead 2.
Which, again, I'd seen before. So
we got somewhere between 230 and 250 people that time. And it was very cool. I mean, we have taped footage of this whole thing where people are excited. The costume contest was great at this one. Mm-hmm. The final three were two buddies of mine, longtime ringers in the costume contest, who dressed as Raoul Duke and Dr. Gonzo from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I remember that.
The movie that had just come out that year. Second prize went to a guy, a very large man who very much of your girth, who dressed up in a full adult diaper and a baby bonnet and a pacifier.
I do remember that.
Third place was a guy, his buddy, who was dressed as Satan, but he talked like The Rock, like as in Dwayne The Rock Johnson, which is really hilarious.
That's crazy.
We had a scream contest in which the kid who won was like 10, and in his final scream, he almost passed out on the floor, the concrete floor in the front of the Grandview, and I have visions running through my head like, oh, shit, this is the end of the marathon.
Well, at least he passed out before Last House on the Left, right?
Yeah, well, he didn't pass out fully, but he got real lightheaded for a second, and time slows down as I watch this 10-year-old kid stumbling forward. I'm like, oh, head wound, crap, this isn't good. The biggest thing about this marathon for me that was terrifying, completely, utterly terrifying, was we set up a whole gimmick beforehand where we wanted to tie in something with Reanimator because we were finally showing it a year later. And so my friend Steve, who worked at a local production company at that point, had a bunch of medical-related gear that he was able to procure from his production company. They were doing a medical-related ad shoot. So everybody got scrubs and doctor's outfits and, like, you know, lab jackets, things like that. And we tried to pitch it as the Miskatonic University class reunion. That was what we could do. Yeah, yeah, sit on the side and laugh it up. It's okay. Yeah, I know, yeah. But we had something, and we had, like a gimmick at the very least. So at the beginning of the marathon, we had this very young, cute gal who worked for me there.
And Worked for me, kids.
She's going to hate me for saying that.
Wow.
She went on to play Mary Jane in Gravity Live the next year. Or, I'm sorry, earlier that year. Yeah, earlier that year. She played the head nurse of the Miskatonic Institute. And the entrance we worked up was that she pushed me on a wheelchair into the theater. And I had, like, a bloody sheet hanging over me as she pushed me in, and she introduced me. I don't think most people knew that I was emceeing that marathon.
Mm.
I just assumed it's like, well, I'll do it, and that's it. And 5 minutes before I was about to go on, I got really scared. I was like, wait a minute. This isn't good. I'm the first person other than Bruce to emcee one of these real-type marathons.
That was 17 years ago.
Town.
By the way. How
I know.
Does that make you feel?
Weird. At the time, it was petrifying. And if you ever watch the tapes, you think we talk long here. Oh, my God. The tape for that event, if you ever watch it, or if we ever make it public, or if you were there, my opening intro was like a 20-25 minute intro. It was like I was trying to toss out every single thing I could think of and say in that time. But the crowd was very forgiving, and they were actually kind of they didn't hurt me too badly. And that was the first time I had the feeling like, wow, I could do this if I needed to or if I wanted to. I could run with this. I can actually. And it's like I had a big acting background, a public speaking background.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I didn't know how to do that. But the crowd actually was accepting me in some ways, you know, because I thought they would turn on anyone who wasn't Bruce and try to do this as an imitator.
Yeah.
You know, I did kind of try to smooth things over by bringing Bruce in that night. He came up and talked in front of one of the films. We, in embarrassing him, it was the, let's see, 1998 would have been the 10th anniversary of the first 24-hour horror marathon in town.
Yeah.
So we, unbeknownst to him, we bought a cake, like a happy 10th anniversary cake.
Nice.
And we got a wooden, like a piece of wood, like a stake stabbed through it. It was a heart cake. That's right. Yeah. It was a cake shaped like a heart, and we stabbed it with like a wooden stake and brought it up to him and gave it to him. So having him there kind of gave me the rub in some ways.
Sure.
That was fun. But yeah, I mean, it happened, and it was a pretty good success.
Mm-hmm.
And the intention was, we'll keep doing this then.
We'll have to put a pin in that, table that for another time, because we're running out of time.
Yes,
here.
Yeah. Okay, so that and that's a good place to stop, actually, because 1999 saw the marathons, the sci-fi marathons, move away from the Rife Center and also started seeing a new evolution for the horror marathon.
With you in charge.
But more on that on the next one, so... As always, thank you for inviting me into the magical studio in the sky.
Absolutely. And we'll see you all later.